Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Linda Calhoun, Vice Chair of the Club's International Relations Forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Douglas Foster, author of After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. Douglas Foster is an associate professor of journalism at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. He received his BA in American Studies from the University of California, Santa Cruz. He is a former newspaper reporter, magazine editor, television correspondent, and documentary producer who now teaches feature writing to graduates and undergraduates while overseeing the journalism residency program in South Africa. Foster also writes for a range of magazines, including The Atlantic, Columbia Journalism Review, Smithsonian, and The New York Times Magazine. Varied newspapers, such as The Los Angeles Times, and web-based magazines, such as Salon.com. He is also a regular book reviewer for The Washington Post. So please join me in welcoming Douglas Foster.
Thanks, Linda, for that introduction, and thank you all for coming. I want to start with a kind of argument about why we should be talking about Africa, and particularly South Africa, on a day when Syria is imploding, and most of the attention, when we pay attention to the rest of the world, is directed to the Middle East. I want to make an argument to my fellow journalists about the way in which we focus attention externally only when there's a calamity. And that fits with one of our standard journalism tropes, which is we pay attention to places where calamitous things are happening. We sometimes pay attention, as we did in 1994 when Nelson Mandela became the first elected black president of a new democracy in 1994, to so-called miracles. And we're not so good at paying attention to people who live in the real world, who aren't icons of reconciliation or disaster, but in fact live real lives in that in-between spot that most of us inhabit between miracle and calamity. Sometimes it's one or the other, sometimes it's both. And what I want to talk about today, rooting us a bit in the landscape, taking us from rural parts of South Africa to the most urbanized and modernized parts of South Africa, to talk about the ways in which a new generation of South Africans are picking up, responding to the promise that was made in the mid-1990s, that the African National Congress, the oldest and most influential national liberation movement in Africa, would figure out a way to construct a kind of society that's never been created in the world before, a truly non-racial, non-sexist, non-homophobic, and more egalitarian society at the tip of southern tip of Africa. So just to get I'll give you a little sense of some of the setting. I know a lot of you are familiar with some of these scenes, but as a way of locating us and placing us in South Africa while these images pass, just tell you a little bit about how I came to go for the first time in 2004, 10 years after the political liberation of the country in 1994. I went, to be honest, not to document the post-apartheid experience. I went to take a group of students from the university where I teach, Northwestern University, to place them in newsrooms there where they would not only do a kind of cross-cultural exchange, but figure out how to produce journalism that was appropriate and useful for South Africans. And I thought I would get them situated in their newsrooms and that I would then set off, because I'm a magazine writer by trade, for other parts of the continent where there were those stories that magazine editors were looking for about calamities in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, in Burundi, and places like that. And what I got hooked on, seduced by, over the course of that first trip in the spring and summer of 2004 was the idea that here was a remarkable experiment underway to create this new kind of society. And it had been faced with these enormous challenges right on the very first day. On the same day that democracy arrived in 1994, two other big world historical forces arrived, as you probably know. One was that the South African economy had been hived off from the world, partly as a result of the anti-apartheid struggle in which the South Africans had been isolated from the world economy, and partly because in some senses the South African economy under apartheid was state capitalism for white people, large state-owned operations that primarily served the interests of the white minority. And all of a sudden, the South African economy was hooked back up to a global economy right at the point of dramatic historical changes, and part of those changes in the changed relationships around the world was that inequality got increased everywhere. So all of a sudden, the linking up of the South African economy to the world economy happens at a point where inequality is being increased everywhere, and that's layered over a 50-year experience of apartheid in which race and class were so tightly intertwined, and hundreds of years of colonial rule. That was number one. Number two, HIV tips into a pandemic right on the same day. So in the door with democracy walks those two other two forces. And I think that's important when we're reflecting on what happened, both on the leadership level and for people living everyday lives. When people come in periodically to South Africa and rediscover poverty from the outside, rediscover the gap between the promises made in 94 and the current situation, and kind of throw up their hands and have a very simplistic explanation that the government has failed. Certainly there have been massive failures by the current government, but I think this context of three very important world historic forces arriving on the same day is important to keep in mind. So just a brief recap on the leadership side, because this project that I then, once I got over resisting the seduction to doing a project in South Africa, became a project to try to tell an upstairs-downstairs story, to try to explain what was really happening on the leadership level and what was happening among poor people and the young. So part of that involved needing to figure out how to tell the story of what appears from the point of view of lots of international reporters to be a story of devolution, right? We start with the legendary leadership of Nelson Mandela in 1994. He's succeeded by the man on the left, Thabo Mbeki, who probably in the U.S. is known more for being a denialist on AIDS than for the kind of stability that he brought to the political system and also to the country's economics. And then in 2009, succeeded by the leader who I spent most of my time with from late 2006 forward, Jacob Zuma, who, if he's known in this country at all, is known most for having been accused of corruption and having been accused of rape, tried on a rape trial, as a result of which he was found not guilty. I spent a fair amount of time with Zuma in 2007. I think one of the reasons that he ended up spending so much time with me is that I didn't meet him at the point when he was on top. I met him at the very bottom of his entire life. I met him at the point when he was subject to corruption charges. I met him at the point at which he had just been acquitted on the rape charge after a long, partially televised trial in which the kind of intimate things that none of us would want to say to the person sitting next to us were broadcast to the entire nation. And I think because I got to know him then, I was able then to chronicle in a deeper and richer way than maybe other people have been able to who came to him at a point when it was clear that he was going to be the leader of the ANC and be the next president of South Africa. His daughter, who is one of the young people whose voices thread this narrative, calls him a bicultural, bilingual person. He's one of those people who raised as a shoeless goat herd, as he himself says, a fatherless child in a rural part of KwaZulu-Natal province. Also, through his activity as a revolutionary and as a fighter and chief of intelligence in the MK, the Umkhonto-we Sizwe, learned about what was going on in the continent. He was imprisoned for 10 years on sabotage charges. That's where he learned to read and write. He really is somebody who is educated and comes up through the movement and became a president for all the challenges that he faces now and may, in fact, lose his post as head of the ANC next month when the party meets. Is one of those unusual people who has been able to, at various points, talk to constituencies that are very different from one another, that come from very different kinds of backgrounds, and begins to, I think for people from the outside, it's, and for people in the cities, actually, very hard to understand how it is that somebody who represents a liberation movement could have made the errors that he made, be the kind of person he is. And that was one of the things that I set out to try to figure out. The second thing that I set out to find out was, what is the next generation likely to do with the freedom that was won in their names in 1994? Half the population is 24 and under. 40% of the population is 18 and under, which means that 40% of the population never lived under apartheid, has only been alive during this dispensation. And their voices, young people's voices, have largely been muted in the reporting out of South Africa. So this project that resulted in the book was about amplifying those voices and making sure that the generational complaints, the generational challenges ahead from the next generation would be heard. Among the people who I spent time a lot of time with is Indaba Mandela, seen here with his two brothers Mbusu and Andile. He was the one who gave me access to a sense of what was going on for the Mandela family. This is the grandson, the son of Nelson Mandela's second son Makoto, who died of AIDS in early 2005. Which is, one more sign, as if we needed one, that you can be from the most iconic, most famous, and beloved family in the country and in the world and still be subject to what comes with drug addiction, alcoholism, and HIV disease. Indaba is one of those interesting transitional figures in a way, grew up in Soweto, didn't meet his grandfather until his grandfather was about to be released when Indaba was 6 years old, and has been largely raised in the new dispensation. He was somebody who really gave me access to begin to understand what was happening in the minds and in the values of the new emerging black elite who are likely to take over in corporate leadership, in political life, in the next 10 to 20 years. What he told me that sticks with me still today is that the thing that worried him most about what was happening to his contemporaries is that they would be overtaken with a kind of bling-bling material culture, get involved in business deals that would put them in great debt for their houses and cars, and disconnect them from their the sense of the background where they grew up. He grew up in Soweto, but at the age of 11 went to live with his grandfather in a mansion in Houghton, which is where Nelson Mandela moved after a short period of going back to the family home in Soweto when that didn't work out. So he was very worried about that and worried about the way in which the essential values of the ANC and of the movement and of that call to create a new kind of society could be maintained. There are six young people primarily who thread the narrative of this book together. Three of them come from well-known families, and three of them come from families whose names have never been in print before. The three who are well-known are, of course, Mandela and then Tutu Zuma, one of the daughters of President Zuma. She gave me access not only to what was happening in the Zuma family as he was rising to power, but what it means for a young feminist woman living in a modernizing African city like Johannesburg to respect and understand traditional values like of her father, who is a polygamist, who is married to four women, who has many girlfriends, and who is trying to put that past together with some sense of what her future will be. And I want to give you just a little sense of the kinds of conversations that access to young people like her gave me. The backdrop to this clip that I'm going to play for you is that I had been talking a lot to her father about how he squared his understanding of polygamy, his own practice of polygamy, how he'd become a polygamist, with a modernizing South Africa. How did he put those two things together? And there is a long explanation for that, which I don't have time to go into today, but it set it up for then going to upstairs, downstairs, almost call and response, in a kind of conversation that the two of them actually didn't have with one another, but did have in a way through me. So I just want to play that clip.
I assume that nothing has changed for you in terms of seeing that as a viable alternative for yourself or your sisters.
Oh, not in a million years.
So, I mean, you're talking about it in terms of what your dad has chosen.
Yes.
Not as something you hold up as a...
No, it's something I am quite against, well, for myself.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I would never in a million years enter into any kind of polygamous situation.
And so do you see that too as kind of a generational thing, and kind of a generational difference between you and him? Or do you think that polygamy and the way he's conducted his private life is likely to go on some level in South Africa for generations? Do you see it as an ongoing thing or as a sort of tradition that will begin to die off?
You know, I don't know. The thing is, it's true. I have a lot of friends, obviously, my age. And majority, and I mean majority of my male friends, are very bad at relationships and are not faithful when they're in relationships. So, it's difficult. I mean, they're not necessarily advocates of polygamy, but their behavior is not that different to a kind of the polygamous culture of
doing things. So they might look down their nose at somebody who's formerly polygamous, but they're doing the same thing. Is that
yeah.
what you're saying?
Yes, yes, that is what I'm saying.
Wow.
So I don't know. So I think it's different. I think definitely there'll be a decrease in people who are polygamous in our generation because there's such a limited, because there's no place for it in modern day South Africa and how, you know, the gender roles and how, you know, society is now defining and has defined itself. There's really no place for it. But that doesn't mean I think people are going to have happy homes. Yeah.
What access to people like Tutu and her sisters gave me, by the way, she is going to be an important continental leader. You heard that prediction here first. Her mother is now, of course, head of the African Union, Nkosi Zana Dlamini Zuma. She is studying in Paris. I would predict that she'll be a very powerful figure within the ANC. And also a continental, maybe even international leader studying diplomacy. But what access to Tutu gave me, I spent, you know, I practice immersion journalism, which means that somebody doesn't do an interview and then get let off the hook quite so easily. It meant that I was hanging around at parties, going with her to school, cross-examining her about the kinds of things nobody wants to answer questions about, and going back year after year after year to see her development over time from the time she was 17 until now in her early 20s. The third person with a well-known name, at least in the South African context, Thomas Marie, is the son of the leader of the opposition, Helen Zille. The one opposition party that consistently polls above single digits in national campaigns. She's now the premier of the Western Cape province, and he gave me access to the kind of community of progressive white kids who are figuring out what their place is in a new post-apartheid South Africa, understanding that many of the privileges and riches that they enjoy were a result of a racially discriminatory system. And Thomas was one of the six who I came to fairly late, but he really opened my eyes to a lot of things, including a kind of self-consciousness about that, about the special place and advantages that white kids hold. He said, he told me that he thought that young white South Africans had been the ones who had benefited most from the political liberation in the mid-90s because, he said, they continued to have preference and privileges in education and corporate life and the rest, but they carry no guilt for being part of a racist system that was obviously creating those advantages. And then there were three unknown, or people with names who hadn't been in print before. Jonathan Persens helped me to understand why South Africa is still such a violent place. A lot of people, there have been lots of PhD theses written about this. Why is the place of the Rainbow Nation still one of the places where with the highest rates of murder and rape? Jonathan, who kind of looks angelic there, is in many ways a interesting and a gentle person. When I first met him, He told me his story, which was having lost his father early. He grew up in a place called Atlantis, not the miraculous Atlantis, but a township outside Cape Town. Very typical of the kinds of places that mixed-race people called coloreds and black people were removed to during apartheid. no industry, no commerce, heavy concentrations of people placed somewhere, and then big surprise that what results is dysfunction, lots of alcoholism and drug abuse. That was the kind of upbringing he had. And one of the big challenges, of course, for the tripartite alliance, the ANC government, has been to figure out how to take those communities and integrate them into a national economy. So when I first met Jonathan, he was a runaway. I was looking for somebody who could give us the picture of the country from the very bottom, living in the streets, living under a freeway bridge that Helen Zilla's son crossed over every day on his way to school. So there was a kind of parallel story that I wanted to tell there. And to my surprise, getting to know him meant then that I was in a position to chronicle one person's trajectory, and quite logical trajectory, but disturbing nonetheless, from runaway to beggar to thief to armed robber and worse. And so Jonathan's story gives us a bird's eye view of what it's going to take, I think, to make a big difference in those crime rates. And he gives voice to that entire part of the South African population. Gwendolyn Dube gives the perspective of somebody who has been knocked down in every possible way and yet represents the ability to show incredible heroism and resilience. This is a young woman who was raped into AIDS at the age of 12. If antiretroviral medication had not been rolled out in South African public health clinics in 2004, she would have been likely dead by the time I met her in 2005. So that victory on the part of Treatment Action Campaign and others both inside and outside the government of finally delivering treatment to South Africans with HIV. She represents that entire population of young people living with HIV. And if you want to have a sense of the scale of what it means to deal with this, both for the leaders and for people in daily life, you think about prevalence of HIV. And maybe turn around and count off 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That's the scale of HIV prevalence now. And so if you can imagine, in a way, a society trying to recover from this terrific historical trauma of apartheid, you layer over that kind of scale. Embodied almost in Gwendolyn's story is the story of tremendous resilience, but also tremendous challenge. When I first met her, she was in a support group for young women, girls, in adolescence, all HIV positive 9, 10, 11, 12-year-olds. Most of whom, unlike Gwendolyn, were not HIV positive through rape. They had been born with the disease, transmitted at birth. After the session, I had a chance to talk to each of them and to ask them what they wanted to become. And Gwendolyn's answer has always stuck with me. She said she wanted to be a doctor and a pilot. And I thought that was fantastic for somebody who had been through the kind of experience she had been through. And so I said, well, I get the doctor part. I understand the doctor part. Explain to me the pilot part. We were, you know, sitting in a hospital, one of the largest hospitals in the world, Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital, outside Johannesburg, and she was sitting in an HIV clinic, so she didn't need to explain the doctor part. She said, yeah, and I want to be a pilot too, so every once in a while I'll be allowed to fly away. She is currently a cosmetologist. She didn't do well enough on her matric exams to go on to medical school, not surprisingly, since she missed about 2 years of school during treatment. But she is the most kick-ass cosmetologist in the history of the country. She gave me access to this kind of understanding of this emerging generation of young women, not from privileged backgrounds like Tutu, who are dealing with the very real legacies of sexism, gender bias, and the rest. And quite forthright, she's very tough. You wouldn't want to do a wolf whistle to her in a dark alley. And then the final person among the six, because I wanted to make sure that I represented rural life adequately, was Vuneni Mabasa, who comes from a small dorp in the north of the country, in Limpopo province, one of the poorest provinces in the country. I wanted to understand what this new generation of boys becoming young men understood about these changes. What were they taking from the old traditions in the areas where they were growing up? What did they make of the promise to create a non-racial, non-sexist, non-homophobic, more egalitarian society in these small towns? So I met Vuneni and a bunch of friends of his because I went to the first speech that Jacob Zuma gave after he was acquitted of rape in Bungeni. And the way I usually cover political rallies is by heading as far away from the stage as you can get. Those set speeches, I can figure out what happened there afterwards. What I normally want to do is figure out what's going on in that audience. What is it that's happening among those people that tells us something about what's happening in the country? So that's what happened. I stumbled off into the middle of the field, and as I crossed the field, I could hear behind me people saying, "Malungu? Malungu?" Meaning a white guy out here. And he and about three of his or four of his friends surrounded me and said, "What are you doing here, dude? What are you doing here, dude?" And I said, I explained that I was an American reporter trying to figure out what was happening in South Africa. I'd been following Jacob Zuma around. I'd been talking to a lot of young South Africans like them. And they didn't believe me. They didn't believe that I could be from America or that I was a journalist. They figured there was some trick up my sleeve. So they decided to test me. And Talent, Vuneni's best friend, said, "So you're American. Okay, so do you know Eminem?" And I said, luckily I was on my game that day. I said, "Of course I know Eminem. In fact, he's my neighbor." And they kind of looked sideways, and I said, "And on the other side lives 50 Cent." At which point they started rolling around howling on the ground because they immediately got it, of course. They had mentioned a white rapper to make it easy for me, and I had extended in the other direction. That was the beginning of a relationship with that group of kids that gave me a kind of access that's unusual, that I've never really had in journalism before, in which I could hang out as a much older person and eavesdrop on the kind of conversations that were taking place that helped me to come to and write with a little bit more authority than I might have otherwise about the current state of this project to create a new kind of society at the southern tip of Africa. Because in the end, the ability to do that is going to rely as much on people like Vuneni and Jonathan and Gwendolyn as it is on the leadership of the NC. So I just want to give you a sense of how that conversation kind of played out, a little sense of what the book sounds like, and then we'll take some questions. So me set the context. I've been away for about a year, and I've been to the African National Congress National Conference, where Thabo Mbeki has been defeated as president of the ANC, and Jacob Zuma has succeeded in knocking him off. And I've come back partly because I wanted to see what the reaction of somebody like Vuneni, who remains a very strong supporter of Jacob Zuma and of the ANC. He told me at one point that he knows how he will vote in 2014 when he's allowed to vote for the first time. He knows how he will vote 5 years later in 2019, and he knows how he will vote 5 years after that. And it will be for the ANC because he considers it the party of liberation. But that's not where things stop for him. He is somebody thinking very deeply about what does it mean, this call to be non-sexist for a boy like him, this call to be non-racial for a boy like him. He remembered, as I came back in, that one of the things he and the other kids had said about why they didn't like Mbeki and did like Zuma was that Mbeki was so pro-woman. And there were all these things that were bad about that, including that women were too much in your business all the time and too bossy, right? So the first thing he said when I saw him again was, that stuff we said about women a year ago, I understand now that that was all wrong. In his early teens still, Vuneni had a rather sophisticated view of trouble that happened between women and men. As the women became more powerful in workplaces and government ministries, he thought that the men were increasingly afraid that they would want to, quote, put the revenge to men, unquote. To him, this was retrograde thinking. He had pledged, in conversations with his mom, not to behave like a sexist bigot. Vuneni volunteered unprompted that he thought polygamy was wrong, not only as a matter of morality, but also for practical reasons. That would not be good for me, he explained, mentioning his right under the law to take multiple wives. So you have one wife and you have kids with her. Then you have another wife and some kids. There will not be enough money to take care of all of them. We passed by the Star Bar Lounge, its black on white sign sponsored by Castle Beer. It was the biggest shebeen in the village, and his mother had told me that she feared its possible influence on her son. She had spoken of the bar as if it were a sentient, malevolent, grasping monster. Several older boys clustered in the doorway calling out to Vuneni, but he offered only a noncommittal wave. When the sun goes down, they'll say, come with us, you can arm yourself. It was my turn to look puzzled. What are they really asking, I said. Oh, he replied, looking down. They'll say, let's go mess with some girls, and we're too young to do that. Maybe they want to get me put under the alcohol. I took a long look at him. He had just turned 14. When I asked, he said that he still enjoyed hip-hop, especially 50 Cent, Tupac, T-Pain, and Akon. He credited listening to the lyrics with helping him with his English. The more he understood the lyrics, though, he was troubled because he felt the artist about what the artists were trying to say. The songs were laced with profanity, sexual innuendo, and hatred of women. It was his deepening faith as a Christian, and also his emerging pro-feminist attitude that raised his objections to the tenor of the songs. One night he had watched a movie set in America, and it showed children cursing, disrespecting their teachers, and jumping in and out of bed. I want to say something to the American kids, he announced. I see them in the movies, and it shows that when they go to school, they don't pay attention. They're always bullying the teachers. I would like them to change. When we got back to the house, Vuneni's 3-year-old sister came running towards us. She banged 2 small rocks together, examined my tape recorder, and asked if she could have it. Vuneni instructed her to stay quiet because there was a question he wanted to ask me. What had I seen at Polokwane, and what did I think it meant for a boy from Bungeni like him? I described how nasty the clashes had been and how President Mbeki and his supporters had been rousted. He shrugged his shoulders. Well, at least something happened at last, he remarked. Bungeni pointed in the direction of a one-room shack that a friend of his was living in. The friend was forced in there alongside 16 other people. Jacob Zuma will give them a four-room house, he said, sounding quite confident. Houses will be bigger. I asked what sort of organizing it would take to improve things in his village. He replied that the needs were all pretty basic: running water, shelter, lights. The ANC had promised these in three national campaigns so far. At the end of our conversation, he looked puzzled when I mentioned that Zuma had ended the rally where we had first met by singing Awaletu Umshinmiwam. Bungeni didn't know any Zulu words, as it turned out, so he had no idea what the song meant. When I told him that the lyrics glorified the power of armed struggle, and machine guns in particular, bring me my machine gun, he looked startled. Zulus. I never heard about the life they live, he said slowly. Bungeni had always assumed that Zulu speakers were more like Shangaan-speaking people than those who spoke isiXhosa. Zulus and Shangaan boys both wear skins, he said. Xhosas don't wear skins. They wear clothes. Zulu speakers like Zuma, in other words, were amakaba, people in touch with the earth. Thabo Mbeki, by contrast, had been a stuck-up, Xhosa-speaking amakoboka. Bungeni restrained himself from going on because in the New South Africa, everyone was equal, right? He knew that ethnic divisions shouldn't matter. That was the official line, anyway. The romantic attachment to armed revolution that I had mentioned, though, was foreign to him. He wasn't alive when the liberation struggle was fought. By this time, the sun was going down, so I gathered up my things. As I was leaving, I remembered to ask him the question I had been posing to every young person I met. Do you feel free? He smirked, smoothed his sweatpants, tapped his feet in the dirt, and leaned back against the rock. Yes, of course, he said brightly. Discrimination is all gone. A black child and white child, we all have the same advantages. We have the same education. We will go to the same university. They are friendly, and we are friendly. It will get better and better. We'll all end up being free. His mother came out on the stoop then, and I snapped pictures of the three of them. Bungeni's sister wore a handmade green skirt and a brown blouse with blooming red flowers. Their mother was caught in a relaxed pose in the reddish glow of the dying sun. The boy stood with impeccable posture. He was the man of the family now. As I bounced along the lane, leaving the village again, I thought of the difficult circumstances Bungeni faced in the years ahead, and once again of all the sacrifices his mother had made for him already. The battle back in Polokwane had been fought, supposedly, on his behalf. It wasn't clear, though, what either side in the ANC had to offer the poor and the working poor in a village like Bungeni. In the face of Bungeni's implacable optimism, though, it made me ashamed to feel so much doubt that the people's government would make a difference for him. I was moved by the fact that he still believed, with such utter confidence, unselfconsciously and without irony, in full political, social, and economic liberation, and that he felt quite sure that it still lay within the country's reach.
Our thanks to Douglas Foster, author of After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa, for his comments here today. I'm Linda Calhoun, Vice Chair of the Club's International Relations Forum, and I'll be moderating today's audience question period. Douglas, we have a large number of questions, so let's begin. I know you didn't really touch on this in your talk, I'm not sure in the book. How will the explosive issue of land reform be addressed in the coming years?
Yeah, it's huge, obviously, the economic issues. As some of you probably know, South Africa very explicitly made a decision. A decision as part of the negotiated settlement was to uphold property rights and not to engage in the kind of dramatic redistribution of land that happened, for example, in Zimbabwe. But the problem is the transfer of land has gone so slowly, and so little land has been transferred to black workers who work the land. And it's a huge controversy right now. There's a tremendous amount of pressure within the ANC to begin to look for ways within the parameters of respecting property rights to move the land reform effort along more quickly.
Thank you. It appears you had amazing access to both South African leadership and citizens. Were you ever denied access or subjected to any censorship with regard to your book?
I'll answer the second one first. No censorship, but yes, many, many, many people didn't agree to talk to me. Very long list. So I would say for every person who's quoted in the book, maybe multiply by 20 the numbers who said no. When you do the kind of immersion journalism that I do, you make your best effort to get the key players to cooperate. But in the end, you're reliant on those who are willing to cooperate. And so, for example, I had access to many advisors around former President Mbeki, but for 7 years, he considered doing an interview with me and in the end never did. Many, many no's along the way in a project like this. And that comes with the territory. Part of this challenge of doing this kind of work is to find the people who will allow you to come back over and over and over again so that you get a fully embodied sense of that human being. If I had done with any of these six young people or the hundreds of other young people who I interviewed over the course of the 5 years, if I had just taken a snapshot and come away with a magazine story, I would have come away with a very different story than the one that's presented in this book. There would have been those kind of moments that you look for in magazine stories where somebody turns a corner and then all of a sudden everything's different, right? And then you come back 6 months later and you see what's different and what has slid back to the same. And that becomes a kind of, I think, more realistic and fully embodied way of chronicling real people's lives.
And Douglas, what was your biggest surprise in terms of, you know, as you look at your experience and, you know, being immersed in the country, culture, population, prior to the start, I imagine there were preconceived notions that you had. As you look back now, what was your biggest surprise?
I think on every page of this book, there is a partial answer to that question, because one of the reasons I couldn't leave after that initial seduction was that every day something would happen that would make me realize that everything I'd read or thought about the country was wrong. I think if it had been, you know, one little piece of it, then I might have gotten out safe by doing a magazine story or two. But the reason it's like that is because much of the reporting that I even edited as editor of Mother Jones magazine when I was there was true insofar as it got beneath the surface of people's lives. But I think the complicated dance, for example, for young people coming of age in the middle of a sexually transmissible pandemic never happened like that anywhere else in the world. This is the place where it most intensely happened. And the willingness and ability of young people like Vuneni, Gwendolyn, Tutu, and the rest to speak openly to an older white outsider about where they were going through and how they were making decisions about their bodies and their lives. That was quite revelatory.
Thank you. One of our audience members asked, going way back, what's the legacy of the Sharpeville massacre, and how is it remembered and viewed now in a contemporary sense?
Well, I think it's right on the surface right now because of the commentary over the shootings in Marikana Lundman Mine in August, in which 34 Wildcat strikers were shot, some of them in the back, by the People's Police. And there was a lot of revival of the images from Sharpeville as if to make a direct correlation. I don't think that correlation holds, but it tells you that those images and the violence of apartheid still has resonance and echoes in present-day life. So I think both the celebration of mass organizing in which the former white regime was forced to the negotiating table, A, but B, also understanding the kinds of sacrifices that people in the generation before his and the generation before that paid in struggle and lives is part of the conversation. Although I have to admit, you know, that 40% of the population 18 and under have the kind of reaction that you all would be probably familiar with your own kids, which is, you know, how much of that history do they want to be told? They might want to develop their own sense of what that history means and not necessarily hear about it from their parents.
Thank you. Another question that we have is, among the polygamists, are there any women with more than one husband?
Yes, there is actually a language group led by the Rain Queen, who is allowed to have as much sex and as many partners as she wants. But that is the one example I can think of, which tells you that it is primarily a situation in some. In some groupings where men are allowed to take multiple wives, and that's legal under South African law. Part of what happened leading up to the Constitution in 1996 was an accommodation between lives as they were being lived in the city and lives as they were being lived in the rural areas.
Thank you. A couple of questions have dealt with what's going on economically in South Africa. Traditionally, I guess since the end of apartheid, you had South Africa's economy sort of on the upswing as you look at the entire African continent. And in fact, South Africa is one of the BRICS with Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. But what, and I know The Economist did a big story on South Africa about a month or so ago, and we all know that a lot of the, there are a number of African countries who are emerging markets that have had phenomenal growth. I mean, we're looking at 10, 12% per annum in some of the countries on the continent. And a statistic that I saw was South Africa's growth is about, projected, I guess, to be about 2%. And in fact, its foreign direct investment is sort of ground to a halt. What's the leadership? What's the media? What's the sense, your expertise, on what's going on economically?
I'm not an economist, and I don't play one on television. But obviously what's happening in the mines has affected what's happening in terms of investment. The spreading wildcat strikes, which are, an expression of long-suppressed desire for higher wages. I think the Economist story itself is another one of those cases where every fact cited was true. The overall picture, I think, had some problems. So, for example, if you compare the largest economy on the continent with a newly emerging economy where there's tremendous growth, you're not looking at the base, right? Mm-hmm. So 2% growth rate in South Africa, deeply disappointing, deeply undercutting of the government's plan to move people out of poverty. In the first 18 years of democracy, 2 million black people moved into middle-income status. Not enough, but not nothing either. And that ability to continue moving people who, by virtue of their race, were placed at the bottom, is threatened by growth rates at that rate. The Minister of Finance said 2 days ago that in order to make substantial differences in creating ongoing social mobility for blacks at the bottom, there would need to be a growth rate between 6% and 7%. So they're far off that. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to point out that that's not disconnected from what's happening in the globe. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason South Africa's growth rate today is at 2 instead of at 4 or 5, which is where it was toward the end of Mbeki's reign, is the meltdown that was created in the U.S. by hedge fund managers in 2008. It's still true that when we get a cold, other people get pneumonia, and that irresponsibility radiated out to the rest of the world. So we are connected to that story.
So it's like they're almost being punished for the fact that they were so far ahead, and when, as you said, the rest of the world caught a cold in the developed countries, it was far worse.
And luckily, there were reserves in South Africa that helped buffer that economy from some of the reverberations from the finance capital meltdown.
And here's a question, because you touched upon that a little bit. How do you, or the country as a whole, reconcile the concept of a non-racial South Africa with the need for affirmative action?
Well, I think the only way you get to a non-racial society in a place like South Africa, where for 50 years the entire educational system was set up to educate black people only to do two things, be domestic workers or mine workers. There's no way to get to a more equitable society without taking that history into account, which is the common understanding of affirmative action. We could quibble about systems, but if we're talking about the general idea that somehow you can proclaim freedom has arrived, we're going to ignore history, we've taken a whole population of people basically and lopped them off at the knees, and now we're going to say, okay, everybody run. Let's see who wins the race. I think that's the alternative. So there is a very active debate about affirmative action between the ANC and the primary opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, and some feeling within the ANC, too, that the way in which affirmative action has been used, black economic empowerment and the rest, have been used only to help out political cronies of the ANC. I think there's some legitimacy to that critique, but that doesn't mean the idea of having policies in place that provide additional support in education, provide placement in higher education, create pressures to make sure that leadership in corporations more fully represents the demography of your country, that there's some fundamental problem with that idea.
And a number of questions that I've gotten, we want some insight into what sort of the future of the ANC and Zuma. One of the questions that I got, the person has spent a considerable amount of time in Soweto with youth ages 15 to 24 and says there's, you know, considerable disappointment and anger with the ANC and Jacob Zuma. So what's next? Can Zuma survive this challenge coming up in December? And what's ahead for the ANC?
At a moment like this, I wish I was there, because you have a very different sense. I mean, I'm often on Skype with friends. I'm often listening to South African media. It's very hard to get the feel if you're away. certainly young people who turned out in unprecedented numbers to vote for the ANC in 2009, despite the predictions that they wouldn't be engaged in the campaign, did respond to Zuma's appeal and the ANC's appeal to be involved. I think as a result of that, there's a kind of disappointment that may be familiar to people who know young people who voted in 2008 for the first time and thought that the election of the first black president in the U.S. was going to mean that problems were solved like that. And I think there is rising anger, no question about it. You know, something like three-quarters of young black men are unemployed in South Africa. If you compare the unemployment rates with, say, the countries that have experienced the so-called Arab Spring, the official unemployment rate is over 24% in South Africa. In Egypt, before the Arab Spring, it was 9%. So there certainly are the conditions for fueling anger and anti-party feelings. So far, in places like Bungeni, that anti-party feeling has been aimed at trying to figure out how the leader went astray, as opposed to raising fundamental questions about whether the ANC should be in charge. And I think the open question for people now is how long it would take a large proportion of the population to come to the conclusion that they would vote for the opposition.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa with author Douglas Foster. And, you know, you talked a little bit, Douglas, about the education system. Can you tell us, in your opinion, what's the greatest strength of South Africa's educational system and also its greatest weakness?
Well, the biggest challenge, of course, when Nelson Mandela became president was to take what was essentially, I think, 18 different education systems and try to integrate them into a national system for educating people across lines of class and race, language and culture. A huge challenge, which the ANC gets a mixed marks at best. Vuneni, for example, is taking his matric exam next week, and that exam, very much on the British system of education, will determine whether he's allowed to go to college and what kind of college he's allowed to go to. He wants to become a doctor, like Gwendolyn. In the province that he's in, Limpopo province, no textbooks were delivered to public schools all year. No textbooks. Huge scandal. The company that was charged with delivering those textbooks had relationships with top party leaders. There's an investigation in Parliament. So, you know, there's a great nonprofit run by a friend of mine in Johannesburg that tried to get books to students like Vuneni. I sent him books and a tutor. But that's the kind of challenge. You know, you have people making up for generations of abuse and discrimination, struggling hard to do the right thing, and then being failed by their provincial government in that way.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we've reached the part in our program where there was time for only one more question. Douglas, this audience member says, your reading ended with the notion that liberation and equality was within reach. Is it within reach?
Well, maybe just beyond the grasp. part of the conversation in this book is about whether there is a future for the kind of hope that Vuneni and other young people in South Africa represent. And the answer to that question, is it in his grasp, is not going to only be decided in Johannesburg and Cape Town and Durban and in Pretoria. It's going to partly be decided by people like us, because the kind of global system that we're part of also lays down the rules under which somebody like him has the wiggle room, is allowed to take a shot to improve his life. Our trade rules, is the distribution of wealth around the world going to be shifted in a way that allows mechanisms of social mobility in the developing world? We are part of a system, everybody in the room knows it, that's unsustainable. We can't go on with China manufacturing everything, including textiles, allowing to swamp this market and destroy the domestic textile operations, in which India takes care of service, Brazil provides agricultural goods, and the U.S. through debt consumes most of the world's goods. I mean, that's the thing that connects him to us, is an understanding that we are part of a web that makes it either more or less likely that somebody like these young people I've been spending time with are allowed to create the wiggle room that helps them to escape from history's grasp.
Thank you. Our thanks to Douglas Foster, author of After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa, for his comments here today. We also thank our audiences here, and as well as those listening to this recording, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.